their passion too.
And that does it for today's show. That was Al Sedlecki speaking to Dr. Lee Buono. Thank you to Dave Isay for joining us. He's the founder of StoryCorps and author of the new book, Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. Amy Goodman will be broadcasting from Seattle tomorrow. She'll be speaking in Olympia, Washington tonight at Evergreen State College Recital Hall. Friday night, she'll be at Seattle Town Hall. On Saturday, it's Mount Vernon at noon. Sunday, she'll be in Eugene, Oregon at 2 and Portland at 7:30. Check our website for details at democracynow.org. This is democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy Goodman will be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next, we have the evening news.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all your support during our recently completed spring membership drive. We can't do it without you. Thanks to all of our renewing members, our new members, and everyone who helped get KBOO to this fantastic place it is today. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
I wanna thank you, baby, for loving me. I wanna thank you, baby, for loving me now. Ooh, ooh.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the United States premiere of Liza, 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 produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Join Liza Minnelli at three different stages of her life, often all on stage at the same time with plenty of songs, backstories about the iconic and troubled daughter of Judy Garland, with a bit of dancing and prancing and much humor among the frightening tales of drink, drug abuse, broken legs, strokes, and hip replacements. Again, that's Liza, 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 May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
Hello, teenage America. My name is Susie Cream Cheese.
Ah, the French. Yes, that's right. It's Mother's Night. It's that time of year again. And for over 35 years, on the Friday before Mother's Day, KBOO honors our mothers. Mothers of invention, that is, with an annual all-night marathon celebrating the early recordings of those untamed geniuses, the mothers of invention. Beginning at 10 p.m. this Friday night and going till 6 in the morning, 8 very short hours from the canon of Frank Zappa featuring rare mothers of invention recordings, unreleased audio disturbances, concert excerpts, dance contests, Zappa interviews, television invasions, fuzzy dice, and rare recordings that the collectors bring in every year that you've probably never heard before, not even last year. So join us for Mother's Night this Friday night at 10 p.m. here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
Rural counties in Oregon see an uptick of candidates aligned with the Patriot Movement.
BARC is organizing a Mother's Day walk this weekend. We will talk to organizers about the details.
And violence escalates in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 5th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. Heads up, bus riders, the new TriMet fare app for smartphones isn't working too well. Yesterday morning, users of the smartphone feature reported that their fares suddenly disappeared from their phones. Media reports earlier this week indicated the app was supposed to go live this morning, but the rollout came a day early. Unfortunately for users, who had already used the older version to activate monthly, weekly, and biweekly passes, plus individual fares that hadn't been used yet. Moovil, the company that developed the app, said the issue affected only users of Apple's iOS products. The Oregonian reports that a fix is in the works. If you've been affected, you can reach customer support at 503-962-2992.
Last week, residents in the Dalles, Oregon, hosted a rally to raise concerns about clean air in their town. Citizens say that they're no longer okay with the high levels of creosote and naphthalene toxins that are in the air. Jennifer Jones of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition spoke with the Dalles Air Coalition members, Rachel, Chris, and Sharon, about their fight for clean air.
We don't need to be scientists. You know, it's okay. It's okay to say, I'm just learning about creosote. As far as I understand it, it's a preservative used on railroad ties. It's highly toxic. It contains these elements. And, you know, I've been shocked to find how poisonous these things are. I can't believe we've been using these for all these years.
Union Pacific owns the railroad ties. They subcontract out with the Maraties, who then soaks each tie in creosote to retard its decomposition as it's used on the railroad track. Why is there a smell?
The smell is coming from before they can use the creosote, they have to heat it. That's where the emissions are coming from, hence the smell.
And the actual smell is from the chemical naphthalene, which is what causes the odor. So it's the chemical in the creosote causing the odor, but it's also the one that causes the most health problems. So it poses the greatest health. The biggest thing is that it's carcinogenic, and I read somewhere that it's 20 times more carcinogenic than smoking. If you're a young boy that's getting 8 vaccines at a time, you have this gene, then you're very susceptible to getting autism, but it also makes you susceptible to toxins. For creosote, you know, it would come out as the side effects of that, which could be cancer. So it doesn't matter where you live, it's still there even if you can't smell it. I'm sad for what's happened to this town for 100 years. I'm sad that it's taken me and my whole coalition to come and figure this out.
Emeritize Holdings is, they have the money, they have the technology, they're building these new facilities, but they're completely forgetting about the other facilities. People in the city don't know about Emeritize Holdings, and they don't know about Emeritize South, so they don't know that the money's there to fix it. Mm-hmm. And they think if they complain, they're going to have to shut the plant down because there's nothing that can be done to make it better. But we know that, like I said, the money's there, the technology's there, but we need to ask for it.
When you have friends and neighbors that have worked and work in Emeritize, this isn't about keeping a bunch of new people safe and healthy. This is about helping the community that is here, has been here for 100 years, has been breathing this air, working down there, right there next to it.
Who feel like they can't do anything about it. You know, they're completely disenfranchised. Uh-huh. They're actually, there's bully tactics that have been used by the company.
Like showing up to your door. To say that they don't smell it when you've reported it. And you smell it, you can't open your windows.
Right.
But they come to your house and say, I don't smell it.
I don't smell it. Your neighbors say they don't smell it. You know, I mean, they're basically saying it's, we don't smell it, so it doesn't exist. You guys are crazy. You're making this up. Definitely. Emeritize Holdings and Union Pacific need to be brought into the situation with DEQ and OHA and the state of Oregon, and then, of course, EPA and federal. I mean, it goes way all the way up.
We've formed our group, TDAC, of women that all feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And some people that want to do other things that maybe don't feel the same way, but we're not going to stop. And so now that we know what we have to do, we're going to do it. So we're coming to you, Salem.
You can learn more about this issue on Facebook. It's the Dalles Air Coalition. Also, their website, www.whatsthatsmell.life. Again, that's www.whatsthatsmell.life.
Every month, the grassroots organization BARC holds a special hiking event where local residents climb on board a vehicle in the Portland area and ride out to an important nature area. There, everyone takes a few hours to hike around and get in touch with the natural world. Then, they get plugged into an important effort to preserve that area. It's called the BARCabout program. This Sunday is a special Mother's Day BARCabout. Here to talk about the program are Adi and Lola. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So I just want to start off by asking, where is this month's BARC hike?
We're going out to the Clackamas River Trail from Fish Creek.
Fish Creek, okay.
South side of Mount Hood National Forest.
Awesome. And what's going on in that spot? Do people need to get active in protecting it?
The Clackamas River area, it has been heavily logged with increasingly large timber sale projects that make it hard for BARC and local citizens to get out and check out and monitor the entire area. What's happening out there? The Jazz Timber Sale is one such project that BARC took the Forest Service to court over and is currently being logged. The land in the Kalawash River Basin, which is a tributary of the Clackamas, is the most geologically unstable area in Mount Hood National Forest. The trees are doing essential work there, and yet the Forest Service is logging thousands of acres, further destabilizing already unstable lands.
And these are national forests you're talking about.
That's right.
And so why did you decide to launch the hikes, and what kind of response have you received from participants?
Getting out into these areas of old growth conveys more clearly to people than any oral description or pictures can show. The diversity of native plant and wildlife within forests is allowed to grow without human management is incredibly amazing, and it's indescribable. So bringing people out so they can see and feel the differences for themselves has been really powerful, and we've gotten that feedback that people have been really impacted. And getting people involved in public process on our public lands is really important to us, that we're passionate about.
What have you learned from previous hikes, or what other previous sites have you been to in the past?
We have done forest ecology hikes, so going out to burned areas, done native plant focused hikes in the Pulali Cooper planned logging area. We've been all over Mount Hood.
Really just everything.
Yep.
That's
just
awesome.
Anything that happens in the forest, we'll go look at it.
And what kind of folks most enjoy these kinds of hikes? Can kids go?
Absolutely. Yeah, this hike is especially open to kids, being a Mother's Day hike. And this is my fourth year leading the Mother's Day hike. Adi is bringing her daughter.
Yeah, she'll be a lot of fun out there.
She's always a lot of fun. She's an amazing activist, age six. And so we're encouraging kids to come out. We'll have some special activities on this hike for them.
What does a typical BARC hike look like? Can you kind of describe? I mean, yeah. Most people just go out into nature and hike, but
right.
You guys have the informational aspect of it.
Right. And I love that it's not required to have a car to get out there, which can be an impediment for a lot of people. We meet up at Trader Joe's at 8:50 a.m. on the second Sunday of every month and carpool out together. It always works out that there's enough drivers, and then we drive out to our location. And the hike is fairly short. We stop a number of times and discuss what's going on in the area and discuss our particular focus for that month. And then we always write letters for the particular project that we're working on, or in past years on this hike, we've written letters to our mothers or to Mother Earth, and just kind of the public getting the public involved in the public process in our national lands.
That is fantastic to hear. You mentioned that you've been involved with BARC for the past 4 years now. Can you talk a little bit about like what the history is and the mission is behind it and how it got started as an organization?
Sure. I'm going to have Audie talk about that.
Go for it.
Yeah, BARC was started actually in the 90s by a lawyer and a musician. This is a story I've always heard. And they didn't want to see their favorite spots be destroyed by commercial logging. And so they decided to take a more policy-based and public interactive approach to getting involved with having control over their public lands. And so BARC sort of stayed on that path. It's just grown larger. It was in a living room, and now it's in an actual office, a pretty nice office, too, if I do say so myself. Yeah.
That's awesome. You guys have a bunch of summer hikes coming up. It's hiking season. Can you talk about what's on the agenda?
Yeah, we have a really great summer being planned right now in the works. We're doing something we haven't done before, which is we're going to have a long-term encampment in the city. And so we're going to sort of match the presence of logging, which is getting bigger, with our presence in the forest, with having a month-long camping trip out there, basically, where every day we'll go out and survey a part of this huge timber sale that's being planned currently called the Hunter Timber Sale. So this way we're going to engage more folks, and we're going to hopefully start intersecting with other groups. And it's going to be really great. There's going to be a lot more information coming. That's going to be in August through September, though. So save the date on that one.
Why is it important for Oregonians to get out into these natural areas and explore their forests?
The history has shown that when left unmonitored, these places become exploited by natural resource extraction. And so if we stick to these pretty well paved paths, we're going to miss a lot of the really important stuff in the forest, which is the huge commercial projects and the exploitation. So it's really important that people get in, check it out, and get involved with the places that provide them water and give wildlife habitat.
And how can people support your work or find out more?
There's so many ways. I think the best thing for folks to do is to just get on the bark-out.org and check out our events. We have a ton of them happening. Kids night, bark hikes, ground truth trainings, campouts, so many different things. Whatever kind of tickles your fancy, then you should just go out and hang out with us, and you'll find your own little niche, just like Lola and I have as bark hike leaders.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming in today. That was Audie and Lola from BARC. Sunday, May 8th is their special Mother's Day BARCabout, heading to the Clackamas River Trail. Carpools leave from the Hollywood Trader Joe's at 9 a.m. sharp. To find out more about their work, go to www.bark_out.com. BARC dash, dash, not underscore. My bad.
The city of Eugene is planning extreme preparedness issues in anticipation of Donald Trump's visit tomorrow night at the fairgrounds right here in Oregon. Eugene police officials today issued a press release urging anyone headed to the event to come as early as possible and be ready for extensive security screening. The police department is trying to get ahead of any kind of violent encounters, and they are appealing to the public not to lose control. Of course, open carry of firearms will be prohibited, and the Eugene police confirmed that they are working with the Secret Service on security measures, which, of course, they declined to describe in any detail. Officials also confirmed that Trump will not be covering any of the cost of security. Rather, the city of Eugene will shoulder the burden. Expected on the scene are Eugene Police, Lane County Sheriff's Office, federal law enforcement agencies, Eugene and Springfield Fire Departments, Eugene Emergency Management Services, Oregon State Police, the Portland Police Bureau, Springfield Police, and the Eugene-Springfield Fire Emergency Medical Services. The Eugene Police Department issued a statement which says, quote, "We have a liaison who is reaching out to identify groups planning to organize demonstrations to help them to prepare to have peaceful demonstrations. Officials have suggested anyone with questions or who is interested in the event go to www.donaldjtrump.com.
Donald Trump has virtually secured the GOP presidential candidacy after winning the Indiana primary. Rival Ted Cruz dropped out of the race Tuesday night, and John Kasich also announced his withdrawal yesterday. Once seen as an unlikely candidate, Trump's primary victories demonstrate that his confrontational and nationalist rhetoric on hot-button issues like immigration and racial equity has tapped into a wellhead of support from seemingly angry and fearful voters. The Trump campaign traction has caught many domestic and foreign observers by surprise. But the U.S. isn't the only country where political forces once considered too far to the extreme right of the social spectrum have moved into the mainstream. In France, far-right nationalism has grown dramatically in recent years, and most notably in the months since the November terrorist attacks in Paris. The anti-immigrant National Front Party made surprising gains in the first round of voting in countrywide local elections last December. A far-right youth group known as Generation Identity has also been growing in its membership. The group describes its genesis as a reaction to their largely liberal parents' generation, who said they sold out their country and their future to migrants. Tom Karstensen has covered nationalistic and right-wing groups and parties in Europe for almost 10 years and files this report from Paris.
The leader of Génération Identitaire, Generation Identity, Pierre Lattie, opens the door to the organization's headquarters in Paris. It's a medium-sized back room with a bar and loads of posters declaring support of the organization on the walls. The neighborhood is a nice part of Paris, with many cafes and small squares.
The goal of the organization is to promote and defend the European identity. And in fact, we see some dangers like immigration, Islamization, globalization.
Generation Identity first emerged a couple of years ago with a video the group itself said was not a manifesto, but a declaration of war. The video spread across the internet, resonating with the hardline sector of youths. The gathering at Generation Identity headquarters consists of all men, with the sole exception of a young woman, who greets the others in the traditional French way of cheek kissing. The office's restroom is decorated with symbols disdained by the group, an Algerian flag, and a number of stickers from left-wing organizations. This evening, Generation Identity's activists are going out onto the streets to put up posters to advertise a yearly celebration they have created in Paris, which doubles as a sort of public recruiting effort. Generation Identity leader Pierre Lattie says the group upholds traditional values and denies being racist, despite expressing clear anti-immigrant sentiments.
We have too much immigrants. I mean, some parts of Paris or some parts of France are not friends anymore. You go out and you have only men, you have burqas.
Generation Identity is not a political party, but most of them vote for the far-right Front National, whose leader, Marine Le Pen, has moved from the outer fringes of French politics to garner more widespread voter support in recent years. Parisian Delphine Marcel says she is not a supporter of right-wing groups like Generation Identity, but that fear in the wake of the November attacks has caused her to change some of her habits and behaviors.
First, the government say, okay, we have to get used to the attack. We are in war and we are scared of a chemical attack. So then I was really scared in the metro, so I bought a car.
Carolina Sanchez is a Danish sociology lecturer at Sorbonne University in Paris. Sanchez says 15 members of her larger social circle, Friends of Friends, died in the attacks in Paris last year, which targeted multicultural neighborhoods and social spaces.
When the right wing demand that moderate Muslims have to apologize, they are helping IS. And they're doing the Islamic State a favor when they talk about Islamization. That is what IS wants, and so did Al-Qaeda. They said it was their goal to eliminate the people who are trying to create a dialogue and the possibilities for peaceful coexistence.
It's not likely the French far-right will moderate its rhetoric anytime soon. The ongoing state of emergency in France has also done little to calm long-simmering tensions in the suburban housing projects known as banlieues, where many Middle Eastern and African immigrants and French citizens of immigrant origin reside. With groups like Generation Identity and the so-called Islamic State seeking to radicalize French youth from different backgrounds, the impact of this polarization on the French mainstream remains to be seen. For FSRN in Paris, this is Tom Carstensen.
Sexual assault is not going away in the U.S. military. The Pentagon announced today that the number of troops reporting sexual violence on the job has stayed the same since 2015. The issue became critical 3 years ago when military officials revealed a 35% increase in sexual assault reports between the years 2012 and 2013. An estimated 26,000 troops have reported sexual abuse ranging from groping to rape. In 2010, about 19,300 troops were in that statistic. United States Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York scolded officials for using misleading statistics and understating the problem of reprisals against soldiers who report assaults. Gillibrand is a member of the Armed Services Committee. Military officials issue their sexual violence report only every 2 years.
Residents of Canada's Alberta province are fighting blazes of wildfires. Areas near and around Fort McMurray are affected, right in the heart of Canada's oil sands reserves, some of the largest in the world. The fires spread across 200,000 acres and destroyed 1,600 homes. So far, no deaths or injuries have been reported. Crude oil production in the area is at a standstill as firefighters work to contain the blaze. Though the cause of the fire is still unknown, higher temperatures coupled with dry conditions are only prolonging the flames.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. This will be followed by Ear to the Streets with Sequoia Wright at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow's weather is going to be 82 degrees and sunny. Today in history, investigative reporter Nellie Bly was born on this day in 1864. Bly, whose real name was Elizabeth Jane Cochran, published a report titled 10 Days in a Madhouse, which had been written after Bly had herself committed to an asylum and then wrote about living conditions there. This resulted in policy reform in New York State mental health facilities. She also wrote Around the World in 72 Days, the real-life story of her fast-paced race around the globe. And the quote for today is from Nellie Bly, who said, "It's only after one is in trouble that one realizes how little sympathy and kindness there are in the world."
It's been exactly 6 months since the Fundão Dam in Brazil's historic mining district of Mariana collapsed, unleashing a torrent of muddy mine waste known in the industry as tailings, 62 million gallons of it. It was the largest tailings spill in history. When the wave of mud surged through the dam, it destroyed the town of Bento Rodrigues. 17 people died. Then the mud poured into the Doce River. Andres Camacho takes us now to the banks of this river 6 months after the disaster to meet the local fishermen whose livelihoods depend on the waters.
A fisherman named Julio walks across what looks like a Martian landscape. An expanse of reddish mud that's dried and cracked under the sun. Just ahead is the Doce River, now an orange ribbon. He says the river is fine. But visual warning signs like its disturbing burnt orange color and the toxic-looking foam in its swirling eddies, suggest otherwise. Julio shrugs, his voice confident.
Mas ainda produz muito peixe.
There are still plenty of fish, he says. Julio starts the motor while his son splashes around in the river. It's hard to imagine that anything is alive in this river. And if it is, it's hard to imagine wanting to eat it. Tailings can contain high concentrations of heavy metals, arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury, neurotoxins that bioaccumulate in the edible tissue of fish. That's in addition to any processing chemicals that were used at the iron mine. In the boat, Julio has a net and a flower-printed dinner plate. When he cuts the motor, he uses the plate like a paddle to stealthily guide the boat in close to where he wants to cast the net. He catches 15 kilos of tilapia that afternoon. The fish have gray scales and ivory bellies. They look normal. Approximately 120 miles downstream, at the mouth of the Dulce River, fishing has been banned since the plume of toxic mud arrived. IBAMA, Brazil's Environmental Protection Agency, enforces the ban through fines beginning at 700 reals. The fishing ban is a precaution in light of concerns that fish stocks may be contaminated by the heavy metals contained in mine tailings. It's unclear why the ban is not in effect upstream. Julio's brother Marquinhos lives on an island in the river along with their father, who goes by the nickname Zezinho Pescador, or Fisherman Little Z. He wears his profession like a title, proudly. He's been fishing the Dulce River for over 60 years. Even the dogs know my name, he says. A cable strung across the river provides electricity here. But the people on this island rely on the river for everything else, food, water, and income. Zezinho says, despite the public concerns about fish and water safety, they've been left with few choices.
Meal, mandioca, batata.
I had fields of corn, manioc, potatoes, beans, bananas, and peanuts. All were destroyed by the mud. Nothing grows in that mud. Now I have to buy food. I've never done that before.
Ironically, after the disaster, they rely on fish more than they ever have. On their current budget, it's easier to catch fish than to buy food at the store. Gianni is Marquinhos' wife.
My daughter doesn't eat the fish. She's scared. I'm scared too. They say it could bring illnesses in the future. Who knows who's telling the truth? I've eaten the fish because I was hungry. I had to eat it. I had no other choice.
Money is in short supply here. Marquinhos' family relies on monthly payments from Samarco, the Brazilian mining company responsible for the spill. Each month, they receive 1,870 reals. That's less than one-third of Marquinhos' income from fish sales prior to the spill. They're barely getting by. Fishing is the only profession Marquinhos knows. So he continues to fish. He's good at what he does. Marquinhos has 700 kilos of fish right now, stored in large freezers. No one wants to buy it. It's understandable why fishermen like Marquinhos and Julio insist that the river and the fish are fine. Maybe if an American journalist reports that the river is fine, they'll be able to find some customers. The family has heard rumors that Samarco is going to stop its payments to fishermen next month. Gianni is worried.
If Samarco truly stops paying like they say, what will we do? Is Samarco going to buy the fish? We can't even give it away. A solution has to be presented or my family will go hungry.
Sometimes news about an environmental disaster can seem distant and abstract. Sure, the mud from a mine spill has left a massive orange stain across a swath of Brazil, but the earth kept spinning. But for the people on the banks of the Dulce River, the fishermen and their families, there's no abstraction here. And while it may not be the end of the world, it is, in fact, an effective end to their way of life. Andrés Camacho, FSRN. Conselheiro Pena, Brazil.
The conflict this week between Israel and the Gaza Strip continues to escalate. On Thursday, Israeli tanks shelled the southern part of the region, killing a Palestinian. During the past 48 hours, Israeli troops have launched airstrikes and tank attacks in various areas of the region, including farmlands, open fields, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad posts. The Israeli army contends that the military action is in response to Gaza mortar shells fired on their engineering crews working near the border. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari reports from Gaza City.
The Israeli army killed a Palestinian woman, a mother in her early 50s, and injured a man in the fresh spate of violence that has broken out in the Gaza Strip. Israeli tanks and warplanes struck multiple locations in Gaza Thursday in what Israel says is a response to Hamas and Islamic Jihad's mortar shells fired on Israeli troops. According to Israeli media, the military actions on the border lines are aimed at subterranean tunnels they say Hamas dug since the end of the 2014 Israeli military offensive on Gaza. Gaza-based armed factions, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, however, insist that Israeli excavations near the border lines violate the ceasefire deal that ended the 2014 war. Amidst fears of further escalation, Gaza residents who have endured three major Israeli attacks on the coastal enclave are hoping for calm. Nader Abu Al-Arraj is a 35-year-old local resident.
In the last war in 2014, both children and adults suffered a lot and were affected psychologically. We really hope that war will not be repeated.
In 2014, Israel carried out a major war on Gaza under the pretext of destroying underground tunnels, which Israel considers a violation of Israeli territorial sovereignty. More than 1,200 Palestinian men, women and children were killed, and 75,000 people are still homeless after many thousands of houses were destroyed. Local media now report that the Qatari ambassador to the Palestinian Authority, Mohammed Al-Ammadi, is mediating a ceasefire. Meanwhile, the Israeli army has beefed up their presence along the eastern borders of Gaza, and the excavations continue. Rami Al-Mighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Environmentalists rate Nigeria's Niger Delta as one of the most polluted oil-producing regions in the world. For more than 50 years, frequent oil spills have plagued the area, mainly from Western oil companies' installations. Pollution from crude spills have rendered farmlands, forests, and fish ponds unproductive. But villagers rarely receive compensation when they seek redress in court. Many say the companies, especially the Anglo-Dutch oil giant Shell, have used their powerful influence to escape liability for the oil spills and resulting environmental damage. Now, villagers from Niger Delta are seeking justice through European courts. Sam Olukoya reports.
Youths play traditional drums in the Ikot Ada Udo village square. A stone's throw away is the scene of a major oil spill from a Shell facility, which changed the lives of many here for the worse. Looking over the scene of the disaster, local fisherman Friday Akban explains what happened.
During the spill, the oil flooded everywhere. The whole of this place was completely flooded with crude oil. It damaged every crop. The spill was so serious. The whole thing was so alarming till it touches the neighboring villages. It was unbearable.
Akban said the spilled oil spread into forests and farmlands and flowed into his 47 fish ponds.
Immediately the spill took place, the rainwater carries the oil down to the pond. The 47 fish ponds. And since the pond is at a slopy portion, the whole oil was pushed into the ponds, and it damages all the fishes I got from the Ministry of Agriculture. I did not get anything from the pond.
It's a familiar story in villages across the Niger Delta, where spills from Western oil companies' pipelines and facilities have wrecked the livelihoods of those who depend on local farmlands and waterways. Children swim in a river in Oruma village. Here, villagers say they have yet to recover from an oil spill that occurred in 2005. Local resident Alali Efanga says the spill destroyed his fish pond, leaving him with no other source of income.
After this oil spill, shell, when this oil spill occurred, all hopes have been lost. For now, I live from hand to mouth. My children too, they are dropped out. I could not take care of their school fees. I could also take care of their medical bills. If that those fish ponds are there, by now, definitely life will be better than this.
Attempts to seek reparation and damages via Nigerian courts have been largely unsuccessful, as foreign oil companies wield considerable financial influence within the country. So Niger Delta residents affected by oil spills are seeking justice in European courts. In March, residents of two villages filed a lawsuit against Shell in a British court. One of them is the Bili community, which villagers say has been so badly devastated by spills that crude oil is seeping into their property. The other village is the Ogali community, where residents argue that incessant pollution has made the water dangerous for drinking, swimming, or fishing. Instituting cases against Shell in Europe has yielded some positive results for Niger Delta villagers. These are villagers from Ogoni, located in one of the most polluted parts of the Niger Delta. A legal challenge in a British court from one Ogoni village forced Shell last year to agree to an out-of-court settlement of $77 million. Shell had refused to compensate the villagers prior to the legal action. Another success story is that of Akban, the fisherman from Ikot Ada Udo. In January 2013, a lower court in the Netherlands ruled that Shell Nigeria's subsidiary should pay him compensation for the oil spill that polluted his fish pond. In December last year, he got a landmark judgment from another Dutch court, which ruled that Shell can be sued in the Netherlands for the actions of its subsidiaries in other parts of the world. Shell is, however, appealing both judgments. Akpan received legal assistance from the International Environmental Organization, Friends of the Earth. Suing Shell in Europe may give hope to a few victims, but thousands of others, like Abo John, say they are too poor to seek compensation from the company.
So this is our community. We suffered a lot in short. My father pond got spoiled. We are suffering because of poverty. If not, we would have shoot these people to court on our own personally. But because of poverty, we cannot take any of them. That is the shell to any place.
Relief is unlikely to come soon for Niger Delta residents affected by oil spills. A report by the United Nations Environment Programme shows that even if current pollution is stopped in Ogoniland, the cleanup of the area will take up to 30 years at a cost of $1 billion. Ogoni covers just a small proportion of the Niger Delta. Beyond the cost and time needed for a proper cleanup lies the seemingly insurmountable hurdle of the lack of political will within Nigeria to hold powerful polluters accountable. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, in the Niger Delta.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jamie Haddad and Lisa Loving. Our engineer, as usual, is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Jennifer Jones of the Eastside Portland Air Coalition and to Free Speech Radio News. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on K282BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on K220HR. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Jamie Haddad. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosts Anya Lin welcome author, mythological scholar, and riveting speaker Michael Mead to talk about his new book, The Genius Myth. At 9, we hear part 1 of a panel discussion on the 2016 presidential election. Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment with speaker, author Vanessa Williamson and Professor Cedric Johnson. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 11, it's part 2 of the 2016 presidential election. Sanders and the Trump contest the party establishment with Professor Cedric Johnson and Thomas Ferguson. Thanks, KBOO members, for helping us come very close to our goal in our spring membership drive. You rock!
Yes, thank you. Most news conversations currently fixate on the presidential elections, but if you pay attention to what's going on at the local level, an interesting story unfolds. Spencer Sunshine is a journalist who's been paying attention to the smaller races, to county commissioners, to sheriffs, and the like, in areas that don't get a lot of attention, specifically counties in rural Oregon. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke to Sunshine about the string of Patriot Movement candidates running for offices around our fair state.
We think that there are at least 14 Patriot Movement-like candidates for office in Oregon, and probably half dozen or a dozen more who we're not aware of or not quite sure about. So there's a major move to run for office right now.
What does it mean if someone is part of the Oregon Patriot Movement? Can you define that as a movement?
First, most of these people, not all, but most of them are running inside the Republican Party. There's a move to take over, and I believe in a couple counties they really have, in Cripp County, for example, have taken over the county Republican Party. Patriot Movement is the successor to the militia movement, which of the 1990s, which itself was sort of a repetition of some earlier political trends, such as the Posse Comitatus movement in the 1970s. It's a radical right-wing movement. It seeks to overturn the political and legal system as we know it in the U.S., and it wants to create a form of radical right-wing decentralization where very little of the federal government power remains, in which there's almost no regulation of a capitalist system, and all of the levers of which we're used to correct for social inequities, for racial bias or anything, or for a safety security net are going to be removed. And the tactic they're best known for is deploying paramilitary formations. In the 90s, these were militias. That's why it was the militia movement. But now we're seeing a whole bunch of different kinds of more decentralized paramilitary formations around, which is why we're seeing like armed action down at the Mosher National Wildlife Refuge.
And as you're doing your research into the Oregon Patriot Movement running for office, what offices are people from the Patriot Movement, as far as you can tell, running for?
Mostly county-level offices. They have a real fixation on the county as a political structure they want to take over. The constitutional sheriffs are almost always county sheriffs. But most of the positions they're running for in this election are county commission positions. Or county judge, which is in Crook and in Harney, the name that's essentially a county.